Your window on the city.
Cambridge 105.
I quite like baked apples in the winter.
There's no fancy pants stuff in there. It's just proper English pork and it's lovely.
It's just a real sort of hubbub of stuff happening.
Do you remember I bought some chickens?
That's right.
That's when we started to sell eggs.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's where it really started.
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
Yeah.
Why did you become a butcher?
It was fun. I was at a friend's house once and I was helping her dad cut up a bit of venison. I didn't even know what I was doing, but I just knew I enjoyed it. Now I can do it properly.
We don't stint on the smoked salmon.
Well,
I don't.
God.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour, an hour of food and drink in Cambridge. And thanks once again to Ian Dayborn for the last 2 hours. I'm Matt Bentman and we are live in the studio. We have a new announcer today, Louise Wilson, who you will have heard presenting 105 Today at various times. But you have a big interest in food, don't you, Lou?
Yes, well, first, it's lovely to be here. Yes, a lot of my background is in food, catering and the like. Small parties, large catering functions such as weddings and a deep interest in the history of food, amongst other things as well. Yeah.
Also here, as usual, is Alan Alder, who's going to tell you what's on today.
Yes, Clowns on King Street closed last month, and already a new establishment is about to open in its place. Matt went to investigate. We report on a new menu at Hot Numbers too, and we found out from Dr. Sue Bailey why there was an exodus of foodies from Cambridge to Oxford a couple of weeks ago. Meanwhile, Louise has been doing some investigating too.
Yes, I've been looking into the history of saffron in Saffron Walden.
We've also got our regular features, Dave Fox from Trumpington Allotments today, focusing on pumpkin growing and crop harvesting. Our news roundup completes today's show.
Did you know that Saffron Walden used to be called Chipping Walden? Why did it change and when? Louise found someone who knows all about it.
What Malcolm White doesn't know about the history of Saffron Walden isn't worth knowing, so I've been led to believe. Once a town clerk of Saffron Walden, but also a local historian who has written several books about the town, he joins me now to tell us more about how it got its name. Hello, Malcolm.
Hi.
Thank you very much for popping into our studios here in Cambridge. So why don't you start by telling us how you got interested in history in general and then more specifically Saffron Walden?
Yeah, well, I've always been interested in history. I studied it at school and at university. And I've just enjoyed history generally and particularly local history. I became town clerk of Saffron Walden in 1976. Part of the job involved looking after the town's archives. And the town's got a marvellous collection of old records going back to the 13th century. And it was studying these that made me decide to write a book about, the first book about the history of the town. I've always enjoyed local history, and the fact that we've got such a marvellous record makes the job a lot easier.
It's a market town, isn't it, really? I mean, that's kind of where...
Yes, it is,
sort of,
yes.
Yeah.
It's a market town. It goes back to Neolithic times, in fact. And it's a very friendly, very convivial town. I've lived there for many, many years now and find everybody very friendly there.
Yeah. So Saffron Walden has a particularly fascinating history, which is the bit that I'm sort of particularly interested in for flavour, because of the way it acquired its name. I think when one hears the name of a place, they kind of take it for granted that it's kind of, it ever has been thus. But until you sort of delve a bit deeper. So tell me more about that, because originally it was called Chipping Walden.
Yeah, Chipping Walden meant market. You've still got other chippings in the country, Chipping Camden, for example. But Walden became famous for its saffron during the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries. We know that it was called Saffron Walden at least as early as 1594. And so saffron was clearly a very important crop for the town to take its name from there. And indeed, it's one of the reasons why the town became very wealthy, why we've got the magnificent St Mary's Church, the largest parish church in Essex, mainly on the back of the saffron trade.
I mean, it's quite unusual, really, because typically it's associated with sort of Middle Eastern countries or Spain or, you know, certainly places that have a hotter climate. But it's unusual that Saffron Walden just seemed to have the right sort of soil and climate to actually grow saffron.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, it was only supposed to grow comfortably on the southern facing slopes. But in fact, the importance of the town was the fact that we're adjacent to the wool growing, the sheep growing areas of Lavenham and Suffolk and what have you. And of course, the crocus was used as a dye for the wool.
Because that's how it started out, isn't it? Yes. The wool industry was actually kind of what it was mostly known for before
that,
wasn't it?
Absolutely, and it was a dye to colour the wool and to provide an alternative to presumably dull grey and white colours.
I mean, it was grown between the 16th and 17th centuries until about the 18th century, when the demand for it dwindled and the industry was replaced by malt and barley.
Yes.
But I understand that there is actually someone now trying to regrow or, you know, get it going again, saffron, in the Essex area with a company called English Saffron, David Smales, and they also grow down in Devon as well. So, but I understand you are looking into this and finding out about how much saffron you actually need to grow.
Yes, well, all I'd say is good luck to him. And apparently you need about 4,000 flowers just to get 1 ounce of dried saffron. The saffron is actually obtained from the stamens of the flower, so you can imagine you need a huge number. And of course, also cultivating it almost has to be manual. There's no proper way of doing it with mechanical means, so of course it makes it very, very expensive.
It's a specific crocus. It's called Crocus sativus, I think.
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And still, weight for weight, it's more expensive than gold, isn't it?
So I'm told, yes.
But when you look at the stats, that's not surprising, yeah, really, is it?
No, it isn't. And certainly you could see that the difficulties in cultivating it, in having the right climate and soil conditions, and being able to manually collect it, means that it does become very expensive.
I was going to say, because actually they all have to be hand-picked, and yes, actually there's a specific time of the day they have to pick it. Is it before the sun comes up? They've
that's
got to pick
right,
it
yes,
and then
yes,
get it out
right,
and yeah, so it's quite
very labour intensive.
Yes, indeed. So obviously, as you were mentioning, it was used for things such as dye and perfume, but obviously here on Flavour we're sort of interested in it being used as a spice. And so, out of interest, do you like paella and things like that? You know, what it's typically used for, I guess.
Yeah, I guess I'll eat anything that's going, but I'm afraid I don't cook with it. My cooking ambitions don't go much beyond baked beans on toast.
But to be fair, it's quite an expensive spice to buy, so probably not one that typically uses it every day anyway. I sort of had a look around, and it's interesting at the way in which they were talking about how we may have actually got saffron here, because as I say, it kind of started out, you know, in Spain, wherever. So I understand there's different stories about how saffron actually came into the country, as I said, because typically it's sort of grown in Middle Eastern or sort of more tropical countries or whatever. But there's an interesting story about a pilgrim smuggling.
Yes, that's right. Supposed to have been smuggled into the town. There was a report in a book in 1599 which said, and I quote, "It is reported at Saffron Walden that a pilgrim, proposing to do good to his country, stole a head of saffron and hid the same in his staff, which he made hollow before for this purpose. And so he brought this root into the realm with venture of his life, for he had been taken by the law of a country from whence it came, and he would have died for that fact."
Well, there we go then. Risking his life to bring saffron into the country. Well, because originally they were trading with Spain down in Cornwall and Devon, the tin. I think that was how it came about. They were originally trading it, and then, as you say, a pilgrim smuggled it in his staff.
Yeah. Certainly, El Saffron was considered to be the most excellent of all other. There was a report in a magazine in 1577 that said that the saffron of England is the most excellent of all. So that the growth about Saffron Walden on the edge of Essex surmounteth all the rest, and therefore bear worthily the higher price by 6 pence or 12 pence, most commonly in the pound.
Oh, well,
so,
yeah.
Ours are considered to be the best in the country. Of course, the saffron was very popular and it's something which the town was clearly very proud. Audley and Mansion, which is lies within the town, was frequently visited by monarchs. And whenever they came to Audley End, they were presented with saffron by the townsfolk. Presentations were made to Queen Elizabeth, to King James, to King Charles I, to William III. And even by the time of George I of 1714, when saffron had died out in the town, nonetheless, they still brought some in specifically to give to George I when he visited the town. So it's clearly very important in the history of the town and in the townsfolk's view of it being an important crop.
Oh, amazing. Well, thank you so much. I think it's very interesting. And I guess not a lot of people necessarily know, that because we don't associate saffron with being grown in England, about how Saffron Walden got its name. But very interesting to find out more about that. Thank you so much for coming down.
Thank you.
Saffron is an interesting spice with lots of uses. And now that it's starting to be grown again, we may return to it to bring further reports.
Every fortnight, Bums on Seats brings debate and discussion on the latest movie releases. From blockbusters to art house, our panel of reviewers are passionate about film.
There's one thing in common, and that's that I think they're all absolutely brilliant.
Well, you can see the ending by watching the trailer, because I was surprised they show it in the trailer.
You wouldn't know it was the ending if you hadn't just said it.
And we'll agree to disagree.
No, I don't agree.
Hosted by Toby Miller.
We take the latest cinema releases for a dance and a drink and report back on which ones have turned our eye and captured our heart, and which ones will be blanking in the street if we happen to pass them.
Join the team. Alternate Saturdays at 12 noon on Community Radio in your city. Cambridge 105.
You're listening to Flavour, coming to you live from the studio at Cambridge 105 Radio. Coming up, the new menu at Hot Numbers, the latest tweets from Cambridge Foodies, and the first news of the Trumpington Pumpkin from Dave Fox, who will be giving us advice on harvesting our crops and what seeds can still be sown. But first, a trip to the other place.
A couple of weekends ago, there was a good reason for Cambridge Foodies to head to Oxford, and at least three of them did. B. Wilson was one, Sue Donohoe another, and Dr. Sue Bailey a third. It was for the Oxford Food Symposium, and as someone who remained in Cambridge because it was a Flavour weekend, I was keen to find out more about it. So on Monday, Sue Bailey came into the studio to tell me about it. Sue, you've recently been to the Oxford Food Symposium. Could you tell us a bit about what the Oxford Food Symposium is?
This is an absolutely fascinating collection of anyone who's got an interest in food, and in fact, for the first time, drink this year. But this is something that's been going for more than 20 years, set up by a gentleman called Alan Davidson, and has now really grown to the largest conference that, or symposium rather than conference, that they actually had this year.
So how many people would have been there, roughly?
There were 270 people there this year. This was in St Catherine's College in Oxford, from 45 different countries.
Mm. And how long is a day's conference or what?
Oh, it's longer than that. You get there on the Friday, and in fact, beforehand, we could have done a wikithon, which was editing well-known people, particularly women in food history, with a woman called Polly Russell, who's from the British Museum. So that was before even the conference started. Then the conference started with a welcome on the Friday evening, a fantastic meal that was produced by a link with Ireland, and it was the Boyne Valley, and they had brought over some of their chefs from one of the technical colleges there, and it was celebrating all the local foods and the amazing meats and so on there. Then there were a few talks, in fact, even that evening. Mm. Then it went on all day Saturday, started about 8 o'clock in the morning after breakfast, went on until about 11:30 at night, Saturday night, and then started again Sunday morning and finished 5 o'clock on Sunday. So full on weekend.
That's a lot of food talking.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So there were a lot of interesting talks then. Could you give us the titles maybe of some of them?
There were some really intriguing talks there, and there were so many that I really wasn't able to go to more than, if you like, a handful, because they were running some sessions in parallel. So there were things like reimagining North African landscapes through food in female French colonial literature by a person called Edwidge Crucifix, lovely name. And then there were other ones as well, cultural identity in Paris. Then global warming, changing food, global landscape, need to preserve diversity. Ghosts in the cane fields, by a gentleman called Michael Crondall, which was intriguing, but I didn't get to go to that one because there were two or three fascinating ones in a parallel session in a parallel room. So there was so much.
Some of those that you've mentioned sound pretty obscure. Was it all rather obscure, or
was it
quite accessible?
No, if you're a foodie, if you're a food person, actually, all the talks were fairly accessible and not academic. And there was a really brilliant person, Don Lindgren from the States, who I follow as Rabelais Books. And he was absolutely fascinating. And he was talking about landscape in the cookbook and the cookbook in its landscape. And he's been doing research apart from being, if you like, an antiquarian bookseller into community cookbooks, which was fascinating that he was talking about.
Has he looked at things like where, when you get the first recipes from a particular culture in another country's?
Yes, so he was linking that into landscape in relation to what he was talking about. So he was looking at sort of purely landscape, talking about, say, Armenian and Persian food, and that's how become suddenly popular. But then in the US, when you get the first introduction of, let's say, Armenian recipes in the US, and so that was in the sort of 1920s.
Right.
And he talked about it in the UK, and this lovely book, Leaves from a Tuscan Kitchen, that was produced in 1899. So there's these historical precedents for appreciating other food cultures found in cookbooks.
Yes, oh, how interesting.
They were fascinating because everyone who was doing a presentation was passionate about their own subject. And then what also is done beforehand is that all the papers for the symposium are available online so that you can download them and then bring them, if you wish, to the actual sessions and then ask questions afterwards as well. And I think probably this year the papers were slightly more academic than in previous years. I'd looked at previous year's papers, which they do publish a couple of years after the symposium.
So they're available for all of us, then?
They're available for everyone, yes. Yeah. They have a Facebook page, they have a very good website, and at least after a year or so, they will publish the proceedings, and they're also some of the proceedings are available as paid-for items.
And since it's a food symposium, the food presumably is both interesting and high quality.
The food is amazing. I mean, that's one of the sort of fun elements of it. The Irish food on the first evening from the Boyne Valley, then lunchtime on the Saturday was from Cupert Cress, which is a Dutch micro herbs and micro cress, if you like, organization.
So that's herbs really when they're at the very beginning, having just sprouted.
Herbs and baby plants, yes. So yeah, absolutely sweet. And they were laid across in little sort of trugs through the middle of the table on sort of some artificial grass with some extra little leaves to taste. So we were challenging ourselves, myself and the lady I was sitting next to identify what the flavours were of some of the other little leaves. And there was an amazing thing called an oyster leaf that actually just tasted like oysters. I want to get some of that.
Yeah.
And then in the evening, we had another meal, which was a Turkish-Armenian meal. And that was fascinating because also there was the first showing of this film about Turkish and Armenian women getting together and sharing their food stories. And it was beautiful because they're sort of two communities divided by a barrier. And then there was an edible landscape made of nuts and seeds, which we looked at and was beautiful. It was like a mosaic. And then everyone dived in and ate it. That was fun. On the Sunday was, again, a very lovely repurposed, if you like, reimagined, proper ploughman's lunch put on by Borough Market. So that was really nice.
Yeah.
And the guy from Borough Market was there, and everyone was very supportive, obviously, of all the horrible things that happened there.
Well, it sounds really interesting, and it's on every year, you say.
This is on every year, and it's open to all. So it's not just for foodie academics. So anyone who's got an interest in food can come along. And you can present a paper as well. The papers have to be submitted normally in February. And then the symposium now is in July. Used to be in September, so I could never go before, so I was delighted to have a chance to go this year.
And how much is it?
It's about £350, £400, but that includes accommodation, it includes food, and it's just such a lovely experience.
Yes, it's not bad for 3 days, actually.
It is student accommodation, admittedly, so it's not plush, but it was perfectly acceptable.
Thanks to Dr. Sue Bailey for that. And a reminder that you can see past papers on the Oxford Food Symposium website. The latest year to be placed there is 2013. And there are some very interesting themes over the years too. Eggs in cookery, vegetables, cured, fermented and smoked foods. It looks like a really interesting resource.
Yeah, and next year's looks good too. It's on seeds, and there's a lot to say about seeds. And I would imagine that we use only a minute proportion of what we could use. Chia is a recent discovery for many of us. You know, what else lurks as yet undiscovered by the West? There are certainly many unusual fruits. The miracle fruit is one, also called sweet berries, and it's from West Africa, and one of the glycoproteins in it apparently binds to your taste receptors and causes anything acidic you subsequently eat to taste sweet, and that removes the need to add sugar. And of course, acidic covers a lot of things, most fruits, for example. Apparently, pressure from big sugar companies has led to it not being developed for use in the West, so who knows what else there is.
Yes, that was featured many years ago on This Morning with Richard and Judy, and they tried lemons and they said, yes, they were sweet.
Yeah, sounds interesting.
Keeping it local. Cambridge 105.
Bagels originate from Tel Aviv in Israel. They're ever so slightly on the sweet side, which means meat and fish tend to go well as fillings, salt beef or salmon, for example. Bagels need to be boiled and then baked to achieve their chewy quality.
We're covering Japan, China, Korea, Vietnam, Thailand. I'm really into all of those types of foods, so I'd take a little bit of something from each one, put together what I know of Western cuisine, you know, it's so you've pretty much got the same levels as a burger. So you've got the meat, you've got the pickles, you've got a mayo in there, and you've got the bun, you've got the salad. It's all the same items. It's just using Asian ingredients and putting something together.
Yeah, now Little Ghost Bagels is a street food business. It's run by Adam Andrews. That was his voice just then. The great thing about Adam is it's music and colour that really drives his cooking, really fuels his experimental side. And as you'll hear, Little Ghost Bagels are very far from traditional.
I use black items. I used to use squid ink for my bread, so I make squid ink bagels. And unfortunately, squid ink isn't kosher, so no baker would make them for me, so I had to convert to charcoal. But the black does sit well with everything I do. I also use pink very heavily. So beetroot goes in a ton of stuff. Beetroot can go on my hollandaise, so it's a bright pink hollandaise, or in the bread and come out of this dark purple bread. And then these beetroot and potato coconut curries that go inside that bagel, so there's a ton of colours, but Little Ghost is heavily focused on black and pink, probably from the inspiration of the band Him. It's strange what desire will make foolish
people do. You're like a Southeast London-based generally.
I've been everywhere, man. I've been in Dalston, Peckham. I did Mop Street Market, it's pretty iconic. Did that for a bit. For Little Ghost, my bagel business, the whole brand is modelled around rock and roll and heavy metal and punk. It was street food. It was a different vibe I was doing. It wasn't working for me, actually. I suppose people don't know what it is when they look at it. That's the problem. And street food is, you know, you've got 3 seconds, basically. People are walking past. If they don't recognise it in 3 seconds, they're out. And they look at me and they just hear metal and see some dude with tattoos standing there and they have no idea what's going on. So I had to stop doing that. It's like a weird little country and western. I've got a Jack White tattoo, obsessed with white stripes. In fact, I couldn't really think of a name that day and I had to register it as a company. So I had this song, Little Ghost, singing in my head all day long. And I went, right, I've got to call it Little Ghost. I've got no choice. Little ghost, what I'm scared of most. Can you scare me up a little bit of love? I'm the only one that sees you and I can't be much to please you. And it's knocking down on me, the Lord above. It's the entire business that plays on one song, really. All of my brunch stuff used to play on the music of the artist Blood Orange, and everything from Little Ghost Bagels was literally Little Ghost, the song from the White Stripes album, just singing, repeating, not even all the words, just repeating over and over and over in my head. Like that's all that I've got. And every time I go out and sell bagels, I'm singing Little Ghost at the top of my voice, that song. Kind of cheesy, and I always think, like, oh God, I gotta stop doing that. With my personal work, I try and do something a little bit different, like I do consultancy jobs, and the colours for that kind of reflects a different style of music I listen to. Artists like Blood Orange, who I actually named my consultancy after. Basically, the music is softer, more sort of electronic and weirder and nicer in a way. My friend. So the colours I just associate with those kinds of things are oranges and yellows and a lot of fruit. I can't help but use music and food and have them together. When I think of food, I have different songs playing from my head. That's kind of how I feel when I'm doing food. Everything I do is 100% focused pretty much around different genres of music.
So now here we are in Hot Numbers Gwydir Street, and Simon Fraser has called on you to come and help revamp his menu.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Gives me a chance to step away from Little Ghost for a few weeks and try something different, really. I've taken what they have on the original menu, taken it up by 10, you know? Really, really pulled it out of the bag on this and added quite a few more things on there. Everything's always in keeping with Asian influences, the foods I enjoy myself. Yeah, just play around with a brunch menu. I really like breakfast. I love breakfast. I've been here a week so far and we've emptied the kitchen out pretty much and put a bunch of new stuff in and hired a couple of chefs and having a good play around, and we've pretty much changed everything. I mean, Hot Numbers Coffee is known for its great coffee, jazz nights, and now craft beer, and they've got a few really nice things on tap. And we just thought the food isn't matching that. And now we've brought it up to a standard where we feel like everything fits really well together. It's fun, it's interesting, and hopefully people like it.
What you thought of the previous menu?
There wasn't much to say about it, really. It was only about 5 items. It was very, very basic stuff. Beans on toast, said, like, they just had fan favourites that they don't sell that many of. The thing is, I've taken what they have on the original menu, added quite a few more things on there. I'm heavily using kimchi on this one, actually. So I've got a couple of kimchi dishes. One is a bacon and kimchi benedict. So we've got smoked streaky bacon, kimchi, 2 poached eggs. We use organic free-range eggs. It's topped off with spring onion, toasted sesame, and it comes with a really strong lime hollandaise, really zesty, really sharp. It cuts through all of that. And all that's served right on top of a gluten-free cornbread that we make here ourselves. So we've already changed everything here. We make everything ourselves. We bake our own breads, and we get in the best quality ingredients we can find. Yeah, I'm really hoping people love it.
Now, kimchi, for anybody who doesn't know,
Yeah, it's a fermented cabbage dish, quite spicy. Sometimes it can have gochujang in it, fermented chili paste, Korean, or Korean chili flakes. It's got fish sauce, garlic, ginger. It takes about a week to make, and then we just sort of chop it up once it's done, and then serve it with bacon and eggs.
Well, I don't mind stealing bread from the mouths of decadence.
We're also going to be running really cool specials each week, different sweet specials, you know, French toasts and pancakes, but there's no maple syrup here, there's no cream, and there's no streaky bacon on these pancakes. We're going to go for something a little bit different. Flavours that you know, flavours that you like, but maybe you might not have had together. Relatively simple, really, but good, interesting, fun.
It's the same attitude you take to all of your other cooking, you know.
Yeah.
Let's do something cool with these pancakes, something that people haven't seen. Yeah.
From following all these Aussie cafes and these brunch cafes, and you see what they're doing, and you look at a breakfast menu in Melbourne, and they won't have one conventional breakfast item on that menu. They won't have a Benedict, they won't have, like, what you know is normal, you know, Avo on toast now, eggs on toast, Benedicts, so these pancakes, they won't have any of that. They'll have 10 items that you've literally never heard of, and people will be having them for breakfast. It just changes the way people look at breakfast, which is cool.
A lot of your business is conducted in London, and London it sets the trend for everywhere else.
Yeah.
A lot of those trends eventually filter up to Cambridge.
Yeah.
I guess that's something that Simon has done here. He's spotted you, and he wants to kind of set a trend himself here in Cambridge.
London's massively oversaturated with cafes, and also a lot of people see these Aussie cafes and want to then open their own. They're not Aussie, and they're not Kiwi, and they've got no Aussies or Kiwis even there. They've just sort of gone for that idea. And that's not really what we've gone for here, but what I have gone for here is thinking, well, London's so oversaturated and there's so much going on, you know, there's a ton of great ones and there's a ton of rubbish ones. It's cool to get out of the town, out of the city, and go somewhere else where there's not as many things going on like that and try and do something like that. It's not the competition, it's just, it's the comparison. When people see you and see what you do, they like to sit there and compare you to 20 other places. So it's kind of nice to come here and just do something fun, do something different. And I'm really hoping that people from London and from everywhere in England actually get to see this. I mean, we're going to pump it out on social media.
Yeah.
Social media is the key. Instagram's the key. It makes people rich, makes people famous. There's all sorts of things. So it's great for food. It's fantastic. It's where I found out about tons of restaurants I've eaten, tons of ingredients I've never thought of using. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic. So, you know, we're going to spend a lot of time on that. Really try and spread the word of what we're doing here now and get a lot of people interested. I want to get a lot of people interested in coming to Cambridge as well.
Cambridge compared to London, Cambridge almost feels like a triangle. And one thing we've noticed is that when the street food scene took off in London and then it took off here, they were able to take advantage so much of Twitter and Instagram and Facebook because all of the customers who were following, they could be at these locations within minutes of either walking, cycling or quickly on the bus. It's such a massive change that all of this social media has made.
Oh, yeah, it's huge. I mean, it kind of makes me think of the film Chef, which I watched recently. I hadn't seen it for a while. It's actually really spot on. A lot of these sort of chef related movies are really not accurate at all. But yeah, in the film he's got his son on Twitter just smashing out those tweets, and everyone know what's going on. You know, next thing they know, they've got quite a big following. They're kind of famous. That's real life. That's exactly how it is.
Well, by the time this is broadcast, Adam's full menu will be available here at Hot Numbers in Gwydra Street. And then, as you say, you're off on your way to Trumpington Street.
Yeah, sure I am. So come on down to Gwydra Street, Hot Numbers Coffee, and try some of my food. See what the chefs have made for you.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Oh, the Little Ghost guys here again, singing weird Little Ghost songs. Christ.
And that was Chef Adam Andrews, now developing a new brunch menu over at Hot Numbers in Trumpington Street. And incidentally, he believes so much in branding and the power of social media that he now only does pop-up restaurants and consulting work, of course, like he did at Hot Numbers. And he enjoys these two things far more.
Amongst Hot Numbers' new brunch menu will be a series of in-house baked focaccias of a
good, thick sandwich size, enough to hold everything together.
In Adam's words, of course.
With fillings like lamb merguez sausage, harissa cream cheese, red onion, smoked streaky bacon, pickled cucumber, and don't forget those changing sweet specials. You can now follow Adam's further exploits via his Twitter handle, at Chef Adam Andrews, all one word. And that music signals time again for the latest tweets from the city.
Yeah, we don't normally put tweets about jobs in this section, but one came through about an hour ago, which is urgent. And it's from Mark Poynton. As we've mentioned before, he's opening up the White Horse in Eaton Socon, and he's looking for chefs of all levels for immediate start. If you're interested, DM at the White Horse ES, ES for Eaton Socon, for details. We've also heard from the Wandering Yak. They're going to be at Stir tonight in Chesterton Road from 5 till 8 approximately, and they're going to be doing, as well as their normal menu, children type food as well. Finally, Mill Road Feast tomorrow, 11 till 4 in Gwydra Street car park. Clown's Cafe closed on the 9th of June with a big leaving celebration for Jenny and Michaela Sokella. It featured in one of our recent Flavour podcasts. The site is currently under construction and due to reopen in a few weeks' time.
Matt popped by to chat with Director John Hodges, a Cambridge academic in neurology and a potter, as he and his family prepare to open up the city's newest cafe, and its name is...
Well, it's called The Locker. My son's the manager, and my son has a dog called Davy Jones.
Ah.
But instead of calling it Davy Jones's Locker, we thought The Locker was a good name for a cafe. Well, we're going for a cross between Hot Numbers and Urban Larder, so we hope the food will be like Urban Larder and the atmosphere and the music and ambience will be more like Hot Numbers. The first floor is going to be very casual, so we're going to have some sofas, coffee tables and exhibitions. Mm. During the summer months, take full advantage of the patio, really, as an outdoor area.
Mm. You know the Suckellers.
We used to come here years ago. I've been in Cambridge 27 years, and we used to bring our children. Interestingly, downstairs, we're returning much more to the design of how it used to be when we came years ago.
Because long-time customers to Clowns know that it went through only two changes, I think, in its 30-year span.
Yes. You know, we're very keen to retain the family aspect that Clowns had. Mm. My son Adam will be the manager. My wife, Carol, is in charge of the art. Our daughter, Naomi, she's going to work here in the holidays. Mm. We want to make it a very community cafe. We're going to run various activities upstairs, some art classes for children and adults. I'm very keen that we're involved with charitable activity and things related to mental health. And art is obviously one of our other big focuses. I mean, obviously, it used to be the Clowns memorabilia and Clowns drawing, and a friend of ours who's an artist, Colin Wiles, who had an exhibition not long ago at Hot Numbers, has done a beautiful painting of Clowns as it was.
Oh, grand.
Which he's finished and we're going to hang downstairs.
That's a lovely sentiment, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I'm a potter. I've made the teacups that we're going to use, the hot chocolate mugs and the sugar bowls, mm-hmm. platters and various things, make it different.
Yes. Can we take a trip downstairs?
Yeah, let's go downstairs.
Okay. That was there before,
yes,
wasn't it? This massive lintel, steel lintel?
Yes. When we first looked around, we were attracted by the industrial nature of downstairs with this huge girder and these vertical... We're told that's an old ship's chimney at some stage.
Really?
It was, So we're making a feature of the girder. We found this pew, the beautiful old pew.
You know, the moment I looked at that pew and the brickwork, it made me instantly think of the cavern, the Beatles cavern.
Yeah, right. And we have an alcohol license, and we understand that we're allowed to have acoustic music. The coffee is very important. I've worked as a barista, so we've bought top-end coffee-making equipment. There's a good proportion of people who don't drink coffee, so we're going to have teas by a company who are really big in Australia called T2, mm-hmm. which I haven't seen much in the UK, though they do have a London base. All the food's going to be locally sourced. We're going to use the Cambridge Juice Company,
mm-hmm.
sourdough bread from Norfolk Street Bakery, and a range of simple, delicious sandwiches and homemade cakes.
Oh, any examples?
Well, like a really good date slice, a flapjack with date in, an orange polenta cake, gluten-free, and a millionaire shortbread. We're also going to buy in things, particularly from Ben, who has the stall in the market.
Oh, yes, we know Ben, yes.
Yeah. Earth's Crust, which is also in the market. Hillary's Fruit and Vegetables, so we can make bacon, brie, homemade onion chutney sandwiches, you know, for instance.
I love homemade chutney. Resist that. Yes.
So I've made a large quantity of onion chutney and homemade spiced apricot chutney. In the winter, we'll probably have a soup of the day, but we're going to have guest pop-up chef evenings.
Oh, good idea.
Yeah. So we're planning to open in the day to start with, similar to the pop-up vans that are everywhere.
Mm.
We've made contact with a number of people who make Malaysian, South Indian, Thai, Mexican, Persian, so they can come in and cater and...
You've got your eyes on some very trendy pop-up makers there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, you mentioned Persian. I'm thinking that's probably Cyrus Nadiri.
The Persian kitchen people. Yes. Yeah, Persian kitchen. There's a really good Malay / South Indian market square stall that come from Northampton.
Yeah.
They're always there on Fridays, I know,
and do
kind of beef rendang, which is to die for. And Inda.
Oh, Inda Bull is going to be involved.
Yeah. So she's interested. And, you know, I think you've got to be diverse in a cafe.
Who decided to strike when the opportunity was available for this place?
Well, I actually have thought about running a cafe as a bit of a sort of pipe dream, or wouldn't it be great to have a cafe?
Yeah.
And then my son said, oh, Dad, would you like to do one with me? And then this became available. Well, when it first came up, we thought, oh, no, you know, it's got a kitchen, it's too big, it's not quite what we're looking for.
Mm.
Then we came back and looked. We thought, well, it's got great potential and the location is fantastic.
Yes, of course.
You know, the location's good. You know, for what we want, we didn't really want a completely tourist-dominated place on King's Parade or somewhere where, you know, you never see the same customers twice.
Yes.
We wanted a community involving location that we would nurture a clientele.
Yeah.
You know, and it was very nice to take over a Cambridge institution.
Mm.
Got a very good relationship with Jenny and Michaela now to continue that tradition in some ways.
That was John Hodges, who, together with his son Adam, a barista, and his wife Carol, will be opening The Locker on 54 King Street over the coming weeks. And Jenny and Michaela will be popping in when they do, because they're all good friends.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
And now to our regular spot for people who grow their own fruit and vegetables. Dave Fox is from Trumpington Allotments, and on Tuesday, Alan caught him, watering can in hand.
Watering your pumpkin, Dave.
Absolutely, not just any old pumpkin. This is the variety is called Atlantic Giant, and so we're hoping to grow a really big one. I've measured it by putting this piece of twine around, so this won't work very well on radio, but that's the diameter at the minute. What's that? About 80 centimetres, maybe?
So it's
getting there, but I had a small accident with it yesterday. I accidentally put my fingernail into it, and that's healed up. But when I made that cut, the water almost came gushing out, so that shows there's a really, really quite high water pressure inside the fruit. So it's swelling really fast now. So I'm trying to encourage all my allotment neighbours, including myself, to come and water it whenever you're passing, because you never know, maybe it might make the show in September.
So how much bigger is it going to get? Any idea?
Come back in a couple of months.
Are you going to need help carrying it?
Well, let's hope so, yes.
Right. One of the things that I've been wondering about looking around the allotment is about tomato plants. And I think most people know that the axillary bud, the little bud that comes between the branch and the main stem, needs to be plucked out. But what about the branches, which can get very big? Should you just leave those and concentrate on the main stem?
Or two of them. Shall we go and have a look?
Yeah, okay. Oh, right. Well, you've got some which are almost ripe.
Oh, yes. I've been eating these for about a week.
Right.
These are sun gold. These are pointy shape. I can't remember what they are. These are the stripy ones are Tigerella. They're beautiful, beautiful tomato. Let's try and find some side shoots and we can see how to deal with them. And tomatoes are extremely vigorous, so they're always trying to create extra branches and more flowers. So typically what we find is, here's an example. So we're looking at the main thick stem of the tomato growing up. We're talking about cordon tomatoes here. They're the ones that you tie up sticks and you try to make them grow tall. Where a leaf meets the large central stem going up, you often find almost always find a little side shoot that actually looks like a miniature tomato plant growing out. And we take that out just by breaking it off, because that way the tomato is persuaded to put more of its energy into growing upwards and producing nice strong trusses of flowers coming off the main stem, which we can support. The trouble with the side shoots is that they're much harder to support, and they tend to be a bit lower down, and of course we haven't got a stake for them, and they get lost amongst the rest of the foliage. If a side shoot gets away and starts becoming almost as big as the main plant itself, then maybe you can think, well, it would be a shame to take that one off at this stage, so we'll put some more support in, find another stick, and maybe treat that one as an extra plant if we possibly can. But in general, try and nip them out early on. There's another little one there.
If you're worried that your tomatoes aren't going to ripen, you know, because perhaps they got off to a slow start or a late start, what's the best thing to do there? Do you want to try and restrict the number of tomatoes that are growing on it?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's have a look at this plant. This plant is actually quite healthy, but its cane is rather short. It's one of previous year's canes, and I could try and stick another cane in to support it, or we could just cut our losses and restrict the growth of this tomato plant. And it's already got this one's got a side stem, actually. So this is here, I can't tell which is the side stem and which is the main one, but this is bifurcated only about 40 centimetres off the ground, so we've got two strong stems coming up, each of which has got about four trusses of fruit on already. So here's a stem, and I'm just going to nip off with a sharp knife the top of the plant, and that'll stop it growing and concentrate the resources into the fruit that's already developing.
Right, good.
So the other thing to do with tomatoes, I suppose, is keep tying them up to encourage this upwards growth, and probably even give them some water in this weather. I don't normally water, but we really have had a lot of warm, dry weather this summer. I mean, it's a cracking summer so far for tomatoes, touch wood.
Yeah.
So lots of water, but then mulch. So as you can see in this bed, I've got quite a lot of grass clippings, and they're good for keeping the moisture in the ground. Let's go and look at the red alert tomato.
Well, these are much smaller and they're not on cordons, but look how ripe they are.
Yeah, that's right. These are a bush tomato. The variety is red alert, which tend to come very early. So the key difference with bush tomatoes is that you don't try and grow them up sticks. They make side shoots, and that's absolutely fine. You don't take them out, just let them do their thing, and they'll make enough side shoots, produce a good crop of fruit, and then you get in there and harvest. So less work overall, the bush tomatoes, and in a dry summer like this, they're winning over the cordon ones, really, because you're getting more fruit per effort that you put in. In a wet summer, the slugs tend to come along and get them as soon as they start to ripen.
Is that why you've got them on straw?
Yeah, that's right, to raise them off in the same way as strawberries, really. Let's get in there for a ripe one and see if it passes the taste test. See what we notice about this.
There's tremendous variety in the quality of the taste of tomatoes, isn't there?
Yeah.
These are nice.
What else do you notice about it?
I notice it's quite cold, actually.
Right, so the canopy of the tomatoes is keeping it cool, even on quite a hot day like this. Other characteristics of this variety is really quite a tough skin. Quite a lot to chew through there.
Yeah.
But that's really good, you know, if you're storing them, or if maybe you're taking them as a gift for a friend or something, they survive the journey. Another characteristic is a lot of the fruits have really got quite a pointy bottom. You know that's a red alert. So I try and grow one crop of bush tomatoes and one or two beds of cordon tomatoes each year, just so I've got that variety. So, you know, if
it's you're covered against the weather.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, something's going to win. See that cucumber just tying it around the cane to try and keep it off the ground. Trying to grow these more vertically than horizontally. And so we've got more space for lots of crops, and you can see then when the vine is tied to a stick, you can then see the fruits hanging down. And of course, that keeps the fruits a lot cleaner as well. You don't get any soil splash, and perhaps hopefully less slug damage if it gets wet. Now, look at these cucumbers. I'm hoping I can persuade you to take a few away.
You
just look for the ones that are. Well, obviously the slightly larger. If you start to see any yellowing at all, that one's fine. If you start to see any yellowing, that means it's mature, and you don't want it to get any older than that.
These are very productive plants.
They're hugely productive, and you know what? These are actually an indoor variety of cucumber. So they're meant to be grown in a greenhouse or a polytunnel. That's what the packet says, but this summer they're doing fine. I had an excess of plants, so I just put them outside to see how they do, and it turned out to be, as I say, a lovely summer so far. So we've got some beetroot, and the thing to do is to harvest these when they're, well, smaller than that. There you go, that's cricket ball size. That's a bit too large. Go for them when they're more golf ball sized, and then you get them sweeter, fresher, younger, lovely. Here's some, here are French beans. These are ready to pick.
Right, now it's important, isn't it, to actually pick some crops like beans.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they won't flower anymore, and you won't get any more beans.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, keep picking, and then you get more. But then you're also getting the younger, more tender fruits. So, you know, better than you can get in the shops.
Right.
Because I think probably most commercial farmers are probably aiming to get something a little bit larger. It's you know, it's got a greater weight that they can sell for more. But when you get them, I mean, this.
But when people go on holiday and they come back, they often don't. Obviously, they've missed picking while they've been away, but there's nothing there for them.
Yeah, they could lose half the crop, yeah. So there you go, there's our topical tip. If you have got a productive garden, or a garden that's even just coming into productivity, and you're going away on holiday, get friends or neighbours to look after it for you. They get some free produce.
And your plants keep on producing
And your plants will still be producing young, tasty fruits when you get back.
Yeah. I think one of the great things about beans in particular, actually, is that when you grow them yourself and you pick them reasonably young, they're not stringy, whereas
sweet,
the ones from the shops
taste,
often
taste
are
sweet.
Stringy.
We're eating here raw French beans.
Oh, they're fantastic.
Sweet. Aren't they just?
They're amazing.
They're really sweet.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm impressed.
Yeah. You don't really need to cook them at all, do you?
No.
In fact, cooking them for longer than a couple of minutes would probably spoil them.
That'd be rude, wouldn't it? This is Variety Hunter, a climbing French bean.
Mm.
Very productive, a flat bean, a bit like a runner bean.
Yeah.
Another thing to keep picking is the courgettes. They're a bit like the just like the cucumbers, really. Want to keep picking take the largest fruit off each day. I'm getting a fruit per day off each of my four courgette plants. So
right.
Please take it away.
Thank you very much. Okay. Do you use the flowers at all?
I don't actually. I don't get around to it. But I think there's plenty of lovely ideas. If you find something cheesy and nutty, and get your flowers in good condition, and then I think most recipes they fry them, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Possibly tie them off somehow and boil them. I don't know, but
I think they usually fry them. The flowers do sell at quite a price, actually.
I'll bet they do, and that's something which if you're in the garden and it's a sunny day and you've got lots of flowers, then that's the recipe for the day. Just don't try and do that recipe on the day when you haven't got good flowers, because it's not going to work. So that's a classic example of the garden should dictate the menu.
Yeah. What can we still sow as the summer progresses?
So lettuce and radish can go in almost any time for the next month or so. For one or two things, it really is the last chance saloon now. So dwarf French beans, beetroot, one or two other things can go in just right now, please. I mean, preferably yesterday. If you're going to sow some dwarf French beans, maybe soak them the night before so that they've got a real head start,
and they
germinate quickly. But other than that, it's time to start planning ahead to next year. So the things we can sow to overwinter. So I'm going to be putting in winter spinach in a couple of weeks' time, and also some spring cabbage seedlings. And then we've got to think ahead and start thinking, well, where are we going to plant our garlic and our broad beans and our other overwintering crops?
Right,
always thinking ahead.
Yeah, good. Okay, thank you, Dave.
Okay.
Thanks. Dave Fox there on a rather windy day. We'll keep you updated on pumpkin progress over the next few weeks, and Dave will be back with his regular feature in two programmes' time.
And Green Onions takes us into the food and drink news now. Over to you, Alan.
Well, let's start by saying how pleased we were on Flavour that there was a night market in Cambridge's Market Square last night, along with a film being shown. We've been campaigning for that sort of thing for some time now, and it's good to see something underway, and there was some really good food. Right, on to the jobs, beginning with Lou.
The Locker Cafe, who we heard from earlier, is looking for a full-time barista and part-time staff. Email your CV to manager@thelockercafe.co.uk.
And Hot Numbers, who we also heard about earlier, they need a head chef and a sous chef. Simply send your CV with a covering letter to info@hotnumberscoffee.co.uk.
Holy Schnitzel Street Food Van is looking for someone interested in a summer job in the city. They pay well and offer perks such as free schnitzels. If that interests you, then contact through Twitter at Holy Schnitzels. And the Plough at Coton is looking for experienced chefs with an immediate start. Email info@theploughcoton.co.uk.
Now, if you want to be an entrepreneur, here is an unusual opportunity. Simon at Shoe Stopper is selling his business because he wants to spend more time with his family. This could be the perfect chance to get involved in the events catering industry under an established name. So for more information, just contact Simon via his email, info@shoestopper.co.uk, and that is spelled C-H-O-U-X-stopper.co.uk.
The Red Lion in Grantchester needs a commis chef. Pop in with your CV. Jamie's Kitchen in Wheeler Street needs a team chef. Pint Shop in Wheeler Street and Cambridge Chop House in Kingsbury are both looking for chef de partie. If you apply for any of these jobs, please mention that you heard about them on Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio.
News now of a community fridge. These are being installed in 30 locations across the country in the next year, one being Cambridge. The idea is that surplus food can be placed in them for others to use as a means of reducing food waste. Typically, each site will have two fridges and one freezer. They'll be monitored by CCTV cameras and robust health and safety measures will also be in place. We'll let you know where they'll be and when they'll be there.
And tonight, there is a food park night market at the Gravel Hill Farm off Maddingley Road. It will be signposted if you haven't been before. Food is provided by Buffalo Joe's, Churro's Bar, Fired Up, The Juice Box, Steak and Honour, The Tin Kitchen, Sub 120, Warm and Toasty, Azaha Spanish Street Food and Road Dogs. And Cambridge Wine Merchants will be supplying soft drinks for tonight only, so you'll need to bring your own wines and beers and gins and or whatever else you fancy. Admission is £4 for adults and free for children. It's from 5 till 10 p.m.
Also tonight at Calfalies in Hooper Street, there's Greek Meze Club. Actually, that's already underway and it's there until 9 p.m.
Tomorrow at the Cambridge University Botanic Garden, a talk about how it is that plants flower and grow at different times of year and according to the season. The talk looks at some recent scientific breakthroughs from around the world in our understanding of how plants sense light and temperature to drive their life cycle. It's on twice at 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. and lasts 30 minutes and takes place in the garden classroom. Normal admission charges apply.
And finally, this Wednesday from 6 till 8.30-ish at the Queen's Head in Newton, there's Azaha with Flavours of Spain. And on the 2nd of August, it's Steak and Honour. And that's all we have time for today. And if you miss bits or if you'd just like to hear the whole thing all over again, the podcast is early next week.
Remember, you can email us flavour@cambridge105.fm or follow us on Twitter @flavour105. And you can follow Cambridge 105 Radio @Cambridge 105.
So, I think that's all from us, really. We will be back on August the 5th. And until then,
goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.